Hi, folks. This is Jordan White. Welcome to Podcast Paroxysm. Today, we're joined by Lee Jenkins, senior writer from Sports Illustrated.
So I guess we'll just get started. So you've had a ton of features out, obviously, on the NBA lately, and your most recent one with Joakim Noah, which was terrific, by the way. How do you had like such a great lead to that story, and I was wondering how do you build those leads? Like, when do you know that like this is how you're going to start the piece?
You know, that's a good question. It's usually, an editor told me a long time ago that it's like, if you were going to meet your buddies at a bar after reporting a story, it would be the first thing you'd say to them, the first thing that kind of stuck out in your memory. That's not always true, but it is sort of often true. It's kind of, you know, what I think is sort of the most interesting moment I had or the most interesting thing the person said. So in that case, it was just kind of this cool scene where we had him, we were doing the photo shoot at this opera house in Chicago. And I kind of heard about it a little after the fact, so I hustled down there to see these kids in this room, and it was the kids who were going to play the Von Trapp children in The Sound of Music. I'm not a big musical guy, so I had to kind of learn about this a little retroactively. But it was just interesting seeing Joakim, like, or hearing about him kind of going into this room and the way he responded to the kids, and it was sort of revealing of him, you know, a guy who, you know, likes music, likes different things, likes to sort of, you know, will sort of follow his whims. I think that's why a lot of people sort of like him and relate to him and his exuberance, which, you know, his way he was cheering for these, you know, these little singing prodigies, was kind of revealing of the excitement he has on the court. So I don't know. I kind of saw a link there, a connection with that showed his personality. Whenever you can show a player's personality in a way that's kind of off the floor or something that's a little more of a human connection, like something that you'd see more in a day-to-day life, I think that's usually pretty revealing, and readers tend to, I think, relate to it.
How was going around with Noah? I mean, is he one of the more different personalities or unique personalities that you've spent time with?
Yeah, you know, I've actually featured him before in October of 2010. It was one of the weirdest situations. I was going to his house, and you know, not a lot of guys like to do the interviews at their house. So when they do, I'm always sort of I'm excited by that and kind of impressed by it that they're willing to sort of, you know, show that part of themselves that's obviously intimate. And he is. I mean, he's one of those guys who he had me over. He's had other reporters over to his house, and when I got there, it was pitch black, nighttime. And all I could see were these, like, flames in the backyard, fire. And I go in the back, and Noah's sitting there at his fire pit, just, like, drinking a beer. He's got the NBA socks on, like, pulled up over his sweats, feet up, and he's just sitting there at this fire pit, you know, just, like, his face was lit up. And he's like, you can sit down and we can start talking. This is where I like to sit and have good conversations. So, you know, we talked for, like, I don't know, maybe an hour and a half that time. And it was great. It was just he's one of those guys who, you know, he's an interesting talker because everything, he speaks slowly, you know, everything's really thought out. But he'll, if you ask him kind of offbeat questions and you take him sort of a little bit away from basketball, you know, he's one of those guys who will go there with you, like a lot of NBA players. I mean, you know, everybody always says, like, well, is he the most interesting? He's one of them. He's one of the most interesting guys. But, you know, the league is filled with guys like that who I think, you know, are willing to sort of show you different sides of their personality, whereas I've covered football, I've covered baseball. I don't see that as much. I feel like it's more hammered into them, indoctrinated toward, you know, this is who you are. You're just an athlete. You're a football player. You're a baseball player. You know, NBA guys, I think, are a little bit more willing. I don't know if it's because they have guaranteed contracts or what, but they're a little more willing to show maybe other sides of themselves.
So who's another player, then, I guess, that would surprise us with that sort of personality?
I mean, I look like Rondo is one of my favorite guys I've interviewed. I mean, he's another, which is funny. I was actually talking about him to Joakim, and, you know, I think I get the sense they don't really like each other. You know, there's definitely a Garnett, Bulls, Celtics, Bulls, Tiff. Going back, but you know, to me, Rondo was one of the most engaging guys I've ever talked to, which was totally surprising because I know how he is sort of post game, and he's he can be very stern and serious. But in that setting, when he was kind of talking about, I was asking him a lot about his rituals and, you know, what he's like day of games, and you know, and he was great. I mean, he was talking about how he showers 5 times a day and, you know, how he has to, like, have that tube of Carmax in his sock. He won't let anybody else use it, and he doesn't like to use the Gatorade that everybody else is drinking, so he doesn't drink anything during the games. You know, all of these kind of quirks, but he was sort of – he wasn't embarrassed by them. I mean, he was kind of, you know, sort of – I think he realizes that he's kind of a quirky genius. So, you know, he's another one. Tyson Chandler's like that. You know, I think Lamar Odom's a really interesting guy. I mean, a lot of the guys I – last guy I profiled was Pat Beverly and right before Noah. And, you know, he's totally different. But he's interesting too, a guy who kind of realizes – I mean, like coming up, I don't know how many people know this, but – so Hoop Dreams was about Arthur Agee. It's obviously a classic basketball movie. And sorry if I'm rambling here.
No, please.
Interrupt me. But so when he, you know, Arthur Agee went on and had a normal life, he went to Marshall High School in Chicago, really difficult area. And then when another big-time point guard came up through Marshall, Agee decided he should go back and film a sequel to Hoop Dreams. I don't know if anybody saw the movie. It was called Hoop Reality. But the point guard it starred was Beverly.
Oh.
And back then, he was like this high score, you know, he came up at the same time as Rose in Chicago. And so he was like, you know, supposed to be a superstar, a big-time scoring guard, combo guard. And then, you know, his whole career gets – so the movie kind of ends as he goes off to Arkansas. But then his whole career goes off the rails. You know, he gets kicked out of school. He ends up going overseas, bouncing around, and sort of realizes at some point, you know, I'm not that guy anymore. I'm not that movie star guard. I have to essentially be you know, the antithesis of it. I have to kind of be the villain in some ways, the guy who slows all those guys down, those star guards. And now you have, you know, to me, he's sort of, you know, part of potentially a breed where you have some teams that have, you know, the Lillards and Rose and Westbrook, these electric point guards. And then if you don't have one of those guys, well, what are you going to do? I mean, to me, it makes sense to go get a guy like Beverly, who's best equipped to essentially drive those guys crazy. You know, like you always hear that. Like, I live in L.A., and you always hear, well, you know, why can't the Lakers ever get a guy who can, you know, stay in front of some of those great Western Conference guards? And the East has a lot of them, too, John Wall. You know, and it's a good question. It's like, if you can't get one of those big-time scoring point guards, you know, get someone to really muck it up with them, even if he's not going to give you a whole lot on the other end. I mean, it makes sense what the Rockets have done and kind of who Beverly is.
How do you ask a player, you know, when did you realize you needed to change? Because it seems like some players would almost be, I don't know about like offended, but maybe like taken aback where you like talk about their depleted role or how, you know, their role has changed from when they used to be, you know, the guy.
You know, I think guys realize in the NBA that like, that they all need an identity and a role. So somebody like, you know, I've never done a piece on Jamal Crawford, but he's one of the, to me, one of the best guys, like one of the best, most approachable people in all of sports. And he's proud to be a six man. You know what I mean? Like, he was obviously the guy when he was growing up, one of the most celebrated high school players ever in the state of Washington. But at some point, I think a lot of these guys realize, you know, I need to take pride in a niche and sort of own it. You know, if you're not going to be like, you know, KD or LeBron or one of those top people, you need a role. And I think guys take pride in that. Like when I showed up to talk to Beverly, he kind of knew, you know, he had some things he it seemed like wanted to say about his philosophy on defense, for instance. And, you know, a great example of that actually is Chandler, you know, a guy who coming up was a massive, I mean, just a huge prodigy, really, a prep prodigy, you know, in L.A. I mean, his high school games were these huge happenings. Goes off to the Bulls, you know, they want him to shoot, you know, he tried to shoot threes. He wanted to kind of be like Dirk or KG. And then at some point realizes, he remembered the game actually. It was a preseason game in New Orleans, and he felt really good about how he played, how he shot the ball. I think he looked at it and he shot, you know, he was maybe like, you know, 5 for 16, and he felt good about it. I can't remember the exact numbers, but I think he realized right then, you know, I can't do this anymore. This is not an efficient way for me to play. You know, this could be the death of my career. I need to commit to rim protection and defense and on the offensive end, catch lobs, roll hard to the rim, dunk the ball. You know, so I think a lot of guys, as they get older, they sort of are able to, you know, to come to grips with who they are in the league and how their style is an expression of their personality. Whereas somebody like Noah is different. You know, he went – he kind of started small, right? He started like in a little box where he was going to be a defender and an energy guy, and with some of the injuries they've had, and you know, Rose injury, Deng leaving, they've now expanded his role to where he's more of a passer. So it's like it can go, you know, it seems like it can go one of two ways. Guys either kind of constrict or they expand, but both ways are equally effective. And I think, you know, I think guys kind of appreciate and are able to hone in on the gifts that they do have.
Right. You said you'd never done, you know, a full feature on Crawford. I was wondering if is there, do you have like an interview bucket list?
Yeah, I sort of do. Circumstances, you know, the circumstances need to be right for a guy. Like sometimes, and there are guys I'd love to do an interview with. Like, don't get me wrong, I would love to sit down tomorrow with Derrick Rose for 2 hours and talk about everything that's going through his head and all his, you know, fears and uncertainties. But some guys don't. It would be impossible for me to even get that interview. And there are a lot of guys like that who you kind of have to wait and go through paces with. I remember kind of doing that with LeBron the first year I was able to talk to him. Like it was a process, and Kobe was like that too when I talked to him. But you know, most players in the NBA, I'd love to interview and have a big story on. You just need to kind of, you know, get the time right and the angle. You know what I mean? Like there are a lot of players who, there's some guys who are good like Noah. And it's more about personality. You know, his personality can carry a piece, right? And then other guys, it has to be more, I think, you know, craft-based. You know, somebody like James Harden, for instance, I don't know how comfortable he is at the times I've talked with him, you know, talking about himself or sort of allowing his personality. It's kind of a weird thing with him because you think he's one of those guys who seems like he'd be this, you know, incredible character and personality and really extroverted just because of the way he looks, but he's not like that. So that's somebody maybe if you do, you have to make it more about craft. And so I'm often thinking about that, like what's the best way to approach this person? Is it more through, you know, his backstory and what he's come from? Is it more through, you know, just his personality, or is it more through his craft?
And does that come through research? I mean, trying to find the story within the story, I guess?
Yeah, it's research. It's also just sort of knowing, you know, kind of knowing your character and, you know, what distinguishes them a little bit. You know them. I mean, you know, we all kind of know a little bit of what these guys are like because they're so out there. You know, you see them every day doing their interviews after the games. And, you know, you just kind of think about, like, you know, what's this person – I mean, I often think about, like, what distinguishes a player or something. What's, like, the distinctive quality about his game? And then the question I try to answer is, well, is that part of his game an expression of something about his personality? You know, because often it is. Often, you know, there's a link there between what a guy's like, his character, and the way he plays. And then sometimes it's different. Like with Noah, I find him interesting because the way his personality is so kickback. You know, he's like a hippie talking about going to the woods and, you know, looking at the leaves and everything. And yet his game is frenetic, right? It's tons of energy, and you know, he's just so locked in, looks almost maniacal on the floor. So that sort of contradiction is also interesting. You know, I try to like start with the game, start with what's on the floor, and then you try to extrapolate it a little bit further out and get to sort of what the player's like, if possible.
Has any player ever surprised you with that? You think it's a manifestation of like their personality is a manifestation of their game, or vice versa, but it turns out they're just completely different from what you expected?
No, you know, I thought JaVale McGee would be funny. and he may be, but like when I sat down with him, it was one of the most difficult interviews, you know, so, you know, he wasn't funny. And, you know, I mean, maybe he was just uncomfortable, or maybe I just didn't do a good job in the interview. But that's one of those where, you know, it was difficult, and I don't know. I thought there would be kind of a carefree nature to him, given the way he plays, and there wasn't. So I guess that's an example. You know, it's interesting. Like Chris Paul's a guy who I profiled, and wasn't the easiest one. And he's one of those guys who like his image is very carefully constructed. But I really think like from him a little bit, and you know, people around him, and he's a really tough guy. He's a really tough leader. I don't think there's a whole lot of separation even between like Kobe and Chris Paul and that kind of breed, that Isaiah Thomas sort of ideal. You know, I think I don't know. I remember thinking going into the Chris Paul story, thinking one way, and then coming out of it thinking that he was a little different. That he's probably an incredibly demanding teammate and person to play with, and a great leader, but maybe not quite as what I thought it would be. If that makes sense.
Yeah. It's funny because I've heard that
he's
too.
He's a killer. I mean, that guy's a killer. You know. And there are a few guys like that in the league who, you know, but most of the guys who are like that is kind of on display. You know what I mean? And maybe that's just because Kobe's that way, but most of those guys, you kind of know who they are. I think Chris Paul, maybe more like Magic or something, keeps it hidden.
Huh. It's funny that you say that because there was like a few days ago, I forgot what channel was on, but it was like Chris Paul's like bowling special or something, or they were doing some sort of like highlight on it, and he lost, and he was furious, and it was just like a charity event, but he did not care. He was absolutely like irate that he lost.
He's incredibly competitive guy, and you wonder how that, you know, that I always go back to that Kobe trade, that Chris Paul trade, and how he would have played with Kobe, you know, how those two guys would have got on together. Because, yeah, he's just one of those people. I didn't know that about him. You know, maybe I should have known. Like, I remember back when he was at Wake Forest, he had that incident. He punched that guy in the groin in that one game. And, you know, there have been signs. Like, maybe I was just slow to it. It's always very possible. But I just remember coming out of that thinking, you know, this guy's a real tough customer. And, you know, I'm sure all of his teammates roll their eyes and say, yeah, we do that. But just from a distance looking at those State Farm commercials, I had no clue.
Do you ever approach teammates or coaches first before you go and talk to your main guy?
Yeah, I mean, that would be ideal. You know, that's the ideal thing. It's like to get some coaches, some teammates. I don't like to go to family members until I've talked to the player. I ask for permission. You know, I don't like ambushing family unless I have the okay of a player. But, yeah, I feel like people like high school coaches, college coaches, they're fair game. So you try to do that to get a sense of you know, to get a sense of what you're dealing with, what the player is going to be like, what he may respond certain ways to, and also just get some fun anecdotes and stories that kind of get you started, you know, get you kind of off and running with a player. Sometimes if you tell a guy, like I just did profile Al Jefferson recently, and, you know, I enjoyed being able to say to him, oh, I talked to this guy and he said this, because there were some funny stories about him growing up. And it got Al kind of laughing and talking about the story and expounding on it a little bit. And then before you know it, you've got a better anecdote, you know, because you had a little bit, and then the player is able to fill in a little bit more, and they kind of know that you're, you know, that you're invested in it, that you're doing some research, and that you care about it.
Has that ever changed your angle? I mean, a little bit, like you get a great story from a guy, and it kind of enlightens you as to their personality or something else, and you kind of want to then take the story in a different direction than what you originally thought.
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, a lot of times you don't know. You know, you don't know what you're doing going in. I mean, I don't know what I'm going in a lot of the time. And then, you know, somebody tells you a couple stories, gives you a couple details, thoughts, and then you sort of go that way. Like with, you know, a lot of my stories I do, they just start because I think the guy seems interesting or cool. Like I'd never, you know, I'd only talked to Al Jefferson for a couple minutes, and I just thought he seemed like an interesting, cool guy who was having a good year. I mean, I didn't know a lot about him. And then, you know, as you kind of dig a little bit deeper into it, you know, players start telling you, oh, yeah, this is the toughest low post scorer I face. You know, guys will say that in the NBA, that Al Jefferson is that good. You know, that he is the guy, you know, that all those, you know, springy rim protectors hate dealing with because he gets them off balance and he scores so easily on them. He's so skilled. And then you kind of learn that about him. You say, well, that's interesting. And then you try to find out kind of the genesis of that and, you know, where that game began in the middle of nowhere in Mississippi, you know, no AAU or very little until he was late in high school. And, you know, and like a portrait, kind of a rural portrait starts to emerge. But, yeah, a lot of times all you have at the beginning is a little shred of something, and you hope all those other people will fill it in.
Do you have, like, a go-to question that you're always going to, like, lead off with so that you can get those kind of stories and quotes?
Oh, I wish. No, I'm not good about that. I mean, you know, a lot of times I'll ask, I have this, like, fear that the guys have had some harrowing experience in their life that I won't know about, that I'll like miss, like that they've, you know, that's one of the reasons I stopped. I used to cover a lot of baseball, and one of the reasons I didn't want to do it anymore is that there are so many players from Latin America, and I felt as though there may be crazy good stories that I was just missing because of language barrier, cultural barrier. So I usually do ask, like, what's the biggest challenge you've overcome? And it's a cheesy question. It's never, I don't think, gotten a good answer. But I'm always worried that, you know, that some guy, like, survived his plane crash when he was six, and I missed it because I was, like, talking about his low post game or something. So I just try to, like, cover myself in that way. But, no, usually the best – I feel like the best questions just come from – are conversational. I mean, I don't ask questions on TV, thankfully, like where you have to ask those very formal questions that tend to get very formal answers. Like my best questions are often, you know, I asked, like last year after the finals, I remember asking LeBron, you know, I just asked him what he did on his off night in San Antonio. And he told me he'd watched, he was just in his room and he'd watched Bulls, Jazz. He'd watched, you know, the Jordan flu game was on TV, and he just watched the whole thing. And then he said, well, after he made the, you know, that jumper to seal game seven, he said, I thought back about that, and I thought, that's my MJ moment. And then he paused and said, no, that's my LJ moment. You know, it was a great quote. It was a quote that I knew the magazine could pull out and, you know, make a fuss with. And it was all just because I asked him what he did on his off night in San Antonio. So a lot of times that's how I feel like the good stuff happens. It's kind of a little bit more casual.
And was that, like, when he said that quote, you just knew that you had
Yeah,
something?
I knew. I'm like, you know, he kind of smiled and said, like, or he said it's my MJ moment. And then he kind of smiled at me and said it's my LJ moment. And I was like, you know, at that point, that's a great quote. That's going to get in my story. You know, it's just, you sometimes you hit that where you just kind of know it's a good quote. He knew, too.
Have you ever had an interview that just went, like, horribly, like, either because the guy wasn't good or it's just, you know, there just wasn't... Yeah.
Mickey. No, I mean, there have been some weird ones. Like, you know, I interviewed Kevin Love once when he was getting a massage. That was a little weird. I interviewed one of my best ones actually was Bynum. Because it was like, you know, Bynum probably gave me – we spent like 4 or 5 hours together. We dropped like $500 at lunch. No booze. So that was kind of a fun one, which is like mechanic. Lamar Odom was weird because it, like, he kind of flaked on me several days in a row, but then, like, then got me, and he just said he had to drive down to Orange County. So we drove down to Orange County, and he, like, went and signed autographs somewhere, and then we drove back. So that was kind of weird. I mean, sometimes you end up in weird situations, but a lot of times I'm like, everybody else, and it's just you're interviewing a guy at the facility or in the locker room or something like that. But I'll be honest, it's fun when you can get them away from that because, you know, these guys are just so recognizable, you know, and so when they're just out in society, it's so interesting to watch them interact. Like, I went to breakfast with Kobe in the fall, and it was at, like, this bustling cafe, like the kind of place you get a number, you know, and then sit down, and they bring you a dish. And Kobe in L.A., you know, it's a pretty wild thing when he's out just in public. You know, people are just going crazy when they see him. So that whole experience of, like, getting, you know, your order number 28, you know, and you're there with Kobe and people are just sort of circling. At first it annoyed me because I couldn't, like, do my interview in a normal way. But then I sort of embraced it because all these people kept coming up to him, showing him their injuries. You know, all these, like, old dudes, like, I had this surgery. And so I kind of – you know, after a while, I was like, you know what, I'm just going to lead with this because it's so funny, all these people coming up and, like, pulling their pants down in front of Kobe. So that was kind of a, you know, a funny thing. But even, like, Bynum, like, walking down the street with Bynum, especially when he was, like, really, you know, going well in Los Angeles, I mean, you're just so conspicuous. It's like people just start screaming. And, again, I don't know if that happens with base players, football players as much.
I guess I'm trying to think of how to phrase this right, but when you have a guy and you know you're talking to him and all those, like the Kobe thing, for instance, when people are coming up and just talking to you, I know you get frustrated, but have you ever had like a player just get really frustrated at that and it just kind of ruins the interview? Or like, I guess how flexible are the players when that stuff happens?
No, I mean, I had a, you know, I think they're usually pretty good. They're so used to it. I'm not used to it. You know, interrupt my conversations. But I had a guy recently say, like, you know, I'm doing an interview. I can't remember who it was. I'm doing an interview. You know, I'll take care of that after or whatever. And, you know, you appreciate that. But you also, you know, look, that's kind of the other side of the deal. It's like when you're in the locker room or in the facility, you know, it's more focused time. When you're out, if you get those moments, if you're lucky enough to get them when you're sort of, you know, out in the world with someone, I think you kind of have to embrace it and just realize how you get to see a little bit of, like, of what they see, you know, when they're out. And because, again, it's body type. It's just because most of them are so large and stand out so much and have all their life, I think it's, you know, it's an interesting lens for a reader sometimes to show sort of what that's like. Like, I profiled Hibbert this year, and I talked to him in his hotel room, and, you know, he was kind of lying on the bed at one point, and I asked him, like, you know, it's kind of a typical question to ask, but I'm like, what do you do about the beds, you know, because he is 7'2". And he's like, oh, I don't have the beds. They have to bring me an air mattress on the road. Like, the trainer has to bring me a separate air mattress. I sleep on the floor everywhere I go. You know, so here he is, like, in the Four Seasons everywhere, and he's on an air mattress. And I just found it interesting for some reason, you know, and we know how big they are. I mean, it's cliche that, you know, they can't, you know, the airplanes and everywhere's cramped and they need their own, you know, tailors and everything. But once in a while, I think it's interesting to just show what, you know, what life looks like from 7 feet tall, because it's, you know, it's different. And the way those guys are gawked at for being that big and then in addition being extremely famous, you know, I think is something worth feeling occasionally.
Do you ever feel like you're more hidden when you're around those guys than we are just, like, in general, since all eyes are on them?
Oh, totally. No, totally. But, I mean, I'm, you know, I'm like that anyway. I'm not, you know, I'm not, like, on TV or, you know, I'm hidden anyway. But, yeah, with them, it's true. I remember talking to a writer once. He'd interviewed Kobe, and he said, like, you will never in your life feel more invisible in public with, like, with Kobe Bryant, especially in Los Angeles. And That was right. That was true.
So then once you have all your material, you got all your interviews and everything, what's your process after that? Is it you?
Yeah, I mean, that's like the great time. I just sit down and write and try to blow through it. I write like just top to bottom. I mean, to me, it's kind of like thinking about what your lead's going to be while you're reporting, so that then when you sit down to write, you're not so daunted. If I have an idea of what I'm going to start with, then, you know, I'll go there and hope the next thing kind of comes to you. I try not to plan it out too much. I try to kind of just get in there and go. I really like pay attention to reporting a lead and then thinking about kind of reporting some sort of narrative, some sort of something with a bit of arc. So if it's how a player's, you know, gotten better from one year to another, or some obstacle he's faced, or, you know, something that he's seen through a team, just kind of reporting an arc. Reporting a good lead, you know, something that's going to be fun to start the story, and then reporting, you know, some kind of arc that'll take you from a beginning to an end. That's usually what I focus on. But honestly, everything, I mean, the biggest hurdles are all just reporting, just like tracking people down, getting time with your subject, especially now, like the playoffs are starting. I'm not going to be going in guys' cars to Orange County. I mean, I'm not going to be, you know, I'll be, you know, going to arenas and trying to get a few minutes here and a few minutes there and piece something together. It gets a lot harder. You know, I'm spoiled because during the season I sometimes get, you know, 45 minutes with a player to sit and talk. And then, you know, I try to present a lot of what that person said. To me, that's a real honor or privilege to have that kind of time. So I'm trying to, like, take that player's or that subject's voice and get it out on the page in a, you know, in a way that's entertaining to read. But when you don't have that kind of time and you don't have so much voice, you know, you need to rely more on other people or your own observation, and that's a little more challenging and to me not as fun. You know, the playoffs, my favorite time of year is like a Tuesday night in January in Charlotte or something, you know, because that's when you can sort of, you know, you can actually talk to the principals, the people who feel this and see it and are, you know, are standing there under the basket for it. Whereas in the playoffs, it gets asked those questions. You ask a question like, you know, what were you doing in your off night in San Antonio in a big group press conference, and everybody looks at you like you're a nut. That's happened to me before.
I wanted to ask you specifically though about the Spurs piece, the 29 seconds one. Did you know going in like I want to do this like by the second, or is that just kind of a thing that clicked later on?
You know, a friend actually suggested that I do it that way. So I don't think, I'm not good at thinking in, as far as like those creative structures. A lot of people I know do that. You know, and you see a lot of that now online, like a lot, like Grantland will do stories in that vein, you know, like different, they'll come up with kind of different structures. And I need to think about that, need to be better about thinking in terms of sort of more creative ways to tell a story. But in that case, to me, it worked perfectly because there was enough going on in those 29 seconds outside of the floor or off the floor. The seconds that were kind of dead time on the floor, I could use to put in like stuff going on around in the arena, in the city, whatever, people watching on TV. So those sort of voices filled in the dead seconds. And then the seconds that were full of activity on the floor, I made more about the basketball. So I'd have those more filled with voices like Popovich or Bosch or Allen, you know, and what they were doing. But that was like a really fun story, mainly because of Pop. I mean, I was really I was nervous going into it. I had to ask him about, you know, one of the worst things that can probably ever happen in his career, if not the worst, in his coaching career. And he was so good on it. I mean, so effusive about it. And sometimes I think some people like to talk about the losses or the failures, the hardships, more than they do successes. Like I walked away from that interview thinking, you know, if it would have been his guy who made that shot, if Danny Green had made it, I don't even know if he would have been as detailed with his memory and his, you know, and what he was willing to share about it. But he really went through those 29 seconds in great detail and illuminated the whole story for me. I mean, other people filled in, like, you know, like Chris Bosh is one of the smartest people in the NBA. He's one of the best, you know, most insightful and reflective people, you know, which is why I always am amazed, you know, how much he gets – how much garbage he takes. But, you know, he's one of those people who really helped out for that story too. So you're going through kind of second by second everything that happened up till that Ray Allen three. And you just realize when you're kind of watching a game in that detail, I mean, Zach Lowe does this for every game every night, but for me it was unusual to watch a game like that. And 29 seconds, I probably watched it 100 times in that detail. You see so much that's going on the floor. You know, I mean, the play that all – the sequence that to me was the most mind-boggling of all was on not the Allen possession but the one previous. LeBron shot this, like, this crazy three. It was low and hard. It was off, like, the bottom right corner of the backboard, and it came off. And Kawhi Leonard tipped it up, and there were four Spurs around the ball. I mean, they just had it covered, including Leonard. He's got these long, you know, such long arms, huge hands. There's only one Heat guy in the picture, and it was Wade, and he was outside of the Spurs. And he, like, jumped up and somehow gets a fingernail over Leonard and gets the tip that ends up going to Miller, that ends up going to LeBron, that leads to the first three. And if that play hadn't happened, and it's improbable that Wade even touched the ball, you know, the Spurs win the title. So that's why it was kind of a cool, you know, just 29 seconds to deconstruct again.
Did you just, like, did you ask Popovich, you just ask him to take you through that sequence?
Yeah, I mean, I told the Spurs in advance I was going to go and ask him about it. But, yeah, and he was, you know, he was extremely gracious. I think enough time had passed that he was, you know, he'd seen it a million times. And, you know, who knows? Maybe it's cathartic. Sometimes for some people, it's, you know, it's cathartic to talk about those things. Again, I know I would probably be like that. And I think he's just enough of a, you know, of a basketball appreciator that he's able to, you know, that he wanted to kind of commemorate Allen's moment one more time, because it really was an incredible thing that he. What I find so amazing, and other people wrote this before me, is that, you know, he had this drill where he would lie down in the key, you know, and spring to his feet and run backwards to the corner and shoot the three. And on his first day in Miami, Spoelstra saw him doing that. And it's like, what are you doing? And he said, well, you never know when there's going to be an offensive rebound. And he's going to run to the corner. I mean, it's almost like, you know, it sounds made up. I mean, but I asked Spoelstra about it, and he told me the story again. And those guys aren't prone to hyperbole. So I just found that amazing that he'd been essentially practicing his whole life for that one shot.
What's your favorite story that you've written? I don't know.
I mean, it was probably – there was a story I did about a – it was about LaDainian Tomlinson. So I know we're talking NBA, so I, you know, I don't know if you want me to go that
way. Oh, no, please, please.
But, you know, he was – it was – I'm from San Diego, and, you know, Tomlinson meant a whole lot to my hometown. And so I was in the New York Times, and I was assigned a story. They wanted just a feature about him. He was in his MVP season. And – you know, I was doing a lot of research and going through a lot of random stories about him, and I'd found this story in like the TCU alumni magazine or something, and it said right toward the bottom that he spent his summers in a place called Tomlinson Hill. And so I just thought it was so random, you know, Tomlinson. And so I went to this tiny little place in Texas. I was going for another assignment anyway to the area, to Texas. And so I stopped in this little town. And I was just poking around and asking people, why is this called Tomlinson Hill and LaDainian Tomlinson is from here? And it ended up sort of leading to this tale about, you know, that these, you know, these slave owners had been there in the mid-1800s and or early 1800s and settled this town, and that Tomlinson's, you know, ancestors and everything had been their slaves. And, you know, it kind of led me to this story about, you know, kids in the town and who actually thought that it was named after LaDainian Tomlinson. And I had to go back and talk to LT about it, which was awkward. But he, you know, he was really, he was gracious and talked a little bit about, you know, the history of it and how he felt, whatever he felt his place was in that. So it was just one of those examples of, you know, I think with a lot of these star athletes, you know, much has been written about them, much has been said. But when you can add another couple layers to that tapestry, I think there's some reward in that.
Well, thank you so much for your time. Before I let you go, though, I want to ask, do you have any playoff picks?
I mean, I'm not a good prognosticator. You know, I picked the Thunder and the Pacers before the season. I'm going to stick with it. I just, you know, it feels like it's Durant's time. It feels like his turn. And it could be wrong, but I remember 2 years ago thinking that about LeBron too, that it was just, you know, it was time for him to do it. And, you know, maybe Durant will have to wait longer. But when I look back at this year so far, it's like it's been the year of Kevin Durant, you know, with all his scoring binges and the way he carried that team without Westbrook. And so it seems like it makes sense that when one player dominates a season or a regular season the way he has, you know, what I know of NBA history, a lot of times that player ends up being the one holding the trophy at the end. So I'll pick Durant and the Thunder.
All right. Well, hey, thank you so much again for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jordan. Thanks for having me.
All right. Have a good day.
Thanks, man.